starting tomorrow night at 11.
It's a quarter to 10 and on Long Wave Now it's time for the Daily Service, which is led by the Reverend Dr. Mark Wakelin. Here on Radio 4 FM, we continue with our Book of the Week, Last Man Off by Matt Lewis. With catches lower than expected, the decision is taken for the Suda Harvard to move to new fishing grounds.
...1400 hours, Thursday the 7th of May. If any of us were expecting something to see when we arrived at Shag Rocks, we were to be disappointed. I had imagined fishing next to a mount rising from the sea. Some of the cliffs rise 70 metres from the water, but we were fishing 40 miles southeast, where the seabed dropped away into the depths of the abyss. The following morning, as the line came aboard, a large fin broke the surface of the water by the side of the boat. Where there had been water before, there was now a killer whale, just a few feet below me, charging on its side. I beamed. The orca were not popular with the crew and were known to steal fish from the line, but I had been waiting to see them all trip. The fishing line twanged and Hunnis swore as the whale plucked a toothfish from the hook just before it broke the surface. A dangling pair of fishy lips was all that remained on the hook, taunting the fishermen. Toothfish would normally be out of the orca's reach in the depths, but now they were like sushi on a 14-kilometre conveyor belt. 0700 hours, Sunday 24th of May. After nearly 2 months away at sea, our fuel was running low, but the hold was only half full, 55 tonnes out of a possible 100. In fishing terms, we were behind and a few weeks off our scheduled halfway landing. Rather than returning to Cape Town, the company settled on Montevideo, with our arrival there planned towards the end of June. Although the Suda Harvard could probably make it to Montevideo without more diesel, it was decided we should join our sister ship, Northern Pride, on the 1,400-mile round trip to refuel from a tanker off the Falkland Islands. A better price could be negotiated from the tanker's owners if both boats filled up at the same time. The boat we were to meet, the Haigong Yu No. 302, was a reefer, one of the nomadic tankers that act as fuel stations for the world's mariners. Our reefer was waiting just outside the 12-mile limit of the Falkland Islands' territorial waters. The Northern Pride went first, approaching the long grey and white tanker from the stern. We waited until they had finished, watching at a safe distance. Then it was our turn to bunker fuel. While the fuel tanks were filled, the engineers ran around the boat, opening and closing valves, operating transfer pumps and monitoring levels. It wasn't long before one of the tanks became full and diesel poured from the breather pipe onto the deck. Every part of every deck of the boat was soon covered in slippery, reeking diesel. Only the bridge escaped uncontaminated. We had taken on 92 tons of diesel, much more than the small top-up we had required, and this meant that we were now carrying over 100 tons of fuel, 60 tons of fish, and a few tons of bait, food, water and kit. The Suda Harvard was low in the water. Saturday, the 30th of May. Back on the fishing grounds, motivated after the short break. A succession of 3 and even 3.5 ton fishing days put another 20 tons in the hold. With 10 days worth of bait left, Joachim estimated there was room for 30 tons more of catch, which meant we would be heading for Montevideo soon. Similar thoughts were running through everyone's heads. After months of disappointing hauls, we were thrilled at the prospect of putting into the halfway landing with a boat full of fish. I was also relieved because I'd finally received a fax from Corinne. I had been sending increasingly desperate faxes and, after 3 weeks without a reply, was sure she had already gone off with someone else. Fortunately, the secretary in Cape Town had only forgotten to relay the messages onto the boat. Saturday the 6th of June. At 1000 hours, I was standing on the main deck of the Suda Harvard looking up at the waves. They were big enough to be casting shadows on the deck, blocking out the sun in the middle of the morning. I knew we were fishing a long way from the equator, and it was winter, so the sun should be low, but Something didn't seem right when the waves were casting shadows. Earlier that morning, I had dressed in full kit, thermals, three pairs of socks, jeans, woolly jumper, padded freezer trousers and waistcoat, hat and deck suit. Staggering along the bucking deck at 07:30, I yelled my greetings to the deckhands as I passed. Bracing myself into a corner in the railings above Jakim, who was on the line hauler, I laughed with Trevor, one of the deckhands, at the conditions we were expected to work in. The boat was rolling and pitching like a rodeo bull. She climbed up each swell and then tipped at the crest before plunging down into the trough. Now and then she punched through breaking waves, only to drop alarmingly and land with a dull thud, making the whole hull shudder. I made a note of the conditions for my daily logbook. Normally, with my arms shoved up inside a large clear polythene bag, I could write on the clipboard without soaking the paper. My system had worked every day until now. I was being pounded so hard by waves and spray that the water was forcing its way in and drenching my notes. I carried on recording the catch, trying to concentrate on my task and to ignore the conditions. But it was impossible. Despite the curse of having me on duty, not to mention the weather, a steady stream of fish was coming up on the line. They were of a decent size, too. There were lots of the 10 to 15 kilogram specimens that, once headed and gutted, would still be as big as a man's thigh. I was glad to step out of the assault from the wind and the waves at the end of my first shift. With my deck suit off, I peered tentatively out of the door for oncoming waves, then timed my run out and up the stairs to the port side of the engine casing, just behind the bridge. In the bridge I found Boerti sitting in his chair on the starboard side. To keep still as the boat pitched and rolled, he kept his elbows locked against the arms of the chair and his feet resting up against the wood underneath the window. "How's it, Matt?" Without taking his eyes off the fishing line coming over the side of the boat, he added, "Are you enjoying the weather today? A bit choppy, eh?" From port to starboard, the front of the bridge was a sweep of carefully angled, toughened glass. Safe behind this screen, elevated a few metres above the deck, I could look straight into the worst of the conditions. There was no break in the weather ahead. Reaching the trough of a wave, a fortress of water reared up to fill our view and the bow disappeared. We hovered in limbo for a few seconds in the white water before buoyancy won out and the white bow re-emerged, defiant. 1400 hours, Saturday, 6th of June. I climbed down the stairs and over the threshold of the storm door into the factory. 2 hours of sampling work lay ahead of me, but the rough weather would make my work treacherous. Each crew member was braced at his station, with their feet pressed against the rusted table legs and walls, thighs jammed against bright stainless steel wash tanks and worktops. Only their upper bodies moved. They swayed in unison with the rolling and jarring of the boat. Melvin, the electrician, had the starboard pump in pieces on the end of the popmaker's bench. It was playing up again, and he was trying to wire up a replacement. With no window to the outside world, there was no horizon to provide us with a fixed point of orientation. We depended on our sense of balance and the timing of the swells to determine which way the boat was moving. This was crucial in knowing when to walk and when to wait, when to grab a slippery 20-kilo fish to take to the freezer, or when to hold on. If we moved carelessly, we could be flung into a girder, a knife, or a spinning winch. I arranged my knives, clipboard, and measuring tools on top of the large metal hatch that led down to the hold. This was a flat surface that I could work on without getting in the way of the crew. Today the fish were coming fast, but due to their large size and the rocking of the boat, it was all I could do to keep them still enough to be measured. At my feet, an icy flow washed from side to side. This should have been draining away through the scuppers in the side of the hull or cleared by the pumps. At the start of my factory observation period, just a few inches of water swilled from one side of the factory to the other. Now, a murky grey torrent poured around the hatches and benches. It washed around the tubs of waste, knocking out guts and tails and purging small fragments from all the grubby corners of the factory. If we stopped fishing this instant, we could stop most of the water coming in. But if Boorti wanted to carry on, the hatches would have to remain wide open and exposed to the weather. I climbed up onto the hatch to escape the water and sat on the edge of a tub. Looking around at my crewmates, I tried to gauge how worried I should be, but no one was panicking. Mark and Alfie continued to head and clean the fish. Joachim even used his video camera to record the water so that he could show his family the conditions when we got back. With all the experienced mariners on board, surely it wouldn't take long to fix the pumps and for the water levels to recede. 1500 hours, Saturday the 6th of June. Joachim and Carlos climbed up the stairs to the bridge. They had each been up to complain before, separately, but the situation in the factory was now at crisis point. Charlie Barron, the bosun, was in close pursuit. These weren't the sort of men to cry wolf, in charge of the deck and the factory. It was in their interests to keep fishing. Together, they might be listened to. Bubbles and Boorti ignored their pleas. From their own vantage point, high on the bridge, the sea looked no rougher than conditions they had experienced 100 times before. "Other boats are still fishing," Bubbles growled. "You don't hear them complaining?" Joachim bustled back through the factory, annoyed and complaining loudly. "Boorti wants to keep fishing. He says we're nearly at the end of the line." He pointed angrily to an emergency fire pump mounted on the wall. "Hannes, Dani, get that down. See if you can start it up." Hannes and Big Dani unbolted the pump and set it on the floor by the washtubs. It looked like a home electricity generator, a rusty metal frame surrounded by a small diesel-powered engine. "If we can just get this running," I thought, "we should be out of trouble." Hannes yanked on the starter cord. Nothing. He passed it to Big Dani, who pulled even harder. We were in dire need of an engineer. At the top of the engine room ladder, I yelled down, "We need help in the factory!" But the noise of the gunning engine was too loud, and my calls brought no response. My search for an engineer was interrupted by Charlie. He fixed my eyes and spoke in a level voice, as though trying to assure me that he was calm. "Matt, I've just been up to see Bubbles and Boorti again, but they don't want to know. It might help if they hear what's happening from you." It was only a short climb up the 2 sets of stairs to the bridge. I stood awkwardly at the doorway, not wanting to step into the room in my factory wear. Bubbles and Boorti were both staring straight ahead. "Has Charlie been up to see you?" I asked. No reply. It felt as though I'd walked in on an argument. Boorti rested his chin on his fingers and stared indifferently out of the window. Bubbles kept his back to me, his rough hands spread against the metal window sills, and his shoulders stretched against the thick knit of his jumper. There was no way they hadn't heard me. "You know there's water in the factory?" "Yes, Matt," replied Bubbles without turning. He scratched at his beard and reached for the inevitable cigarette. "Shut the door on your way out."
Last Man Off was written by Matt Lewis, abridged by Pete Nichols, and read by Sam Troughton. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4.
The Open. Across the BBC. Every blade of grass, manicured. Every grain of sand, in its rightful place. The course is ready. But are the players? Could it be a fairy tale return for Tiger at Hoylake?
And it's another Tiger triumph. He's done it his way, his strategy. Woods wins his third Open.
Or will Justin Rose, Rory McIlroy or Lee Westwood get in his way? The Magic of the Open starts on Thursday morning from 9 on BBC Two and BBC Five Live.
Who's Who in the Cabinet Reshuffle? Isabel Hardman of The Spectator joins Jenny Murray after the news to analyse what the changes mean, and Cheryl Gillan, MP, reflects on her experience of joining the Cabinet.